Ezekiel Kralin writes from San Francisco, when I'm in Fort Bragg. I'm not in Fort Bragg right now. I'm doing the show by live remote from Juanita's apartment. When I'm in Fort Bragg, Ezekiel calls me from his apartment and reads his story. Last week, he started reading his story and got about halfway through it, and I had to stop him because while he was reading, I was checking to make sure if everything was working, and I found out that that it wasn't. I was actually not on the air in either Fort Bragg or Ukiah because something went wrong, and, you know, almost of a sabotage level. I don't want to sound paranoid, but, you know, creepy kind of... anyway, Jerry re-upped the passwords and everything that you need to know in order to connect and accidentally knock somebody off the air like somebody probably did to me. I don't know, accidentally on purpose, I don't know. But it pissed me off. Although this is about as pissed off as I ever get. And do I sound out of control and pissed off? No, I just finished doing my show for the purpose of the recording and put it up on the web. And it's a pretty good show. You can go to my weblog, memooftheair.wordpress.com. Right now, if you like, and download last week's show, and it's all there. If you didn't hear the first part of the show tonight and you want to hear maybe something earlier, if you like what you're hearing now and you think it might be just as good earlier, then you can wait until tomorrow night when I've had a chance to finish the show tonight and also go to sleep and then wake up and upload it to my website so that you can download it and enjoy it. Tomorrow night... memoofthear.wordpress.com. I'll say that again. memoofthear.wordpress.com. That's another way that you can enjoy the show if you're capable of enjoying it at all. And I think you are. I think you are. Part two of Angus McOgg's Bounty. That's the title of the story that Ezekiel Kralin read the first half of on last week's show. This is actually chapter 14, or rather the Part 2 of Chapter 14 of Free Me From This Bond by Ezekiel J. Kralin. In Zekeblog, zekeblog.wordpress.com, as follows. And of course, that is also where Zeke and Arwen were brought together for the first time in what will eventually turn out to be a most astounding gay bromance. But it didn't start out that way. For unbeknownst to Jean at the time, Arwen was an undercover detective, embedded at the hole in order to bust a group of Hell's Angels running drugs through all the gay bars south of Market, plus two bars here in the Castro. One of these two, the Detour, has since shut down. But Zeke had already fallen head over tail for Arwen, so refused to leave the saloon when Arwen had confronted his newfound buddy. Jean, it is very dangerous for you to hang out here, especially when you're a friend to me. He lowered his noble orange-haired head and looked at Zeke directly in the eyes. So will you please go now? With that, Arwen returned to his billiards, leaving Jean in a gloomy space. Never spoke to him again, at least not for 5 sad years. Actually 3, but memory loss made it seem longer. Zeke refused to leave the hole. He loved Arwen that much, at least was rather delighted to watch from afar Arwen's antics around the pool table and listen to rock and roll pounding through hyper-amped speakers and let thoughts of his Johnny, sink into the moors of forgetfulness, capital M, capital F, for some reason. Though be assured that should anyone ever threaten Jean at the hole or later the Eagle, Arwen would abruptly drive them out with great anger, which eventually cost him dearly, as he was instructed by South of Market drug lords to never defend Zeke or there'd be Hades to pay, and so he did. His room was burnt down, and Jean was dosed with intent to drive him insane. In a little more time, without either speaking a word to the other, as Arwen would not allow, Zeke figured out the situation, that Arwen is an undercover sleuth, and that cleverly became Arwen's sidekick. He played the lure, the fall guy, and decoy, which made the Orange County detectives work far easier by bringing these drug-dealing, murderous skanks out of the woodwork. Eventually, though, Jean was driven out of the hole for good, by a violent threat of a sharp blade to his gut should he ever show up there again. Of course, Arwen was not present at the time, and the bartender on duty chose to look the other way. Thus, Zeke had no choice but to leave the hole for good. So, Jean started hanging out at the Eagle Tavern a few blocks away, 12th and Harrison, for he knew that Arwin enjoyed frequenting that space too. Sometimes, when he could afford it, a rare occasion, he'd buy Arwin a drink, though only via the barkeep's hand, as Zeke still could not speak to Arwin or even get within 10 feet of him. About a year later, Jean discovered Arwin working at a taqueria right next door to his now verboten hangout, the Hole in the Wall. So, every Wednesday, Zeke would order a small meal and enjoy watching Arwin at work, a 6'4" handsome giant who towered above the several diminutive Mexican workers, an absolutely sweet and sometimes hilarious scenario of which Arwin was quite aware and made the most of. Still, Jean was not allowed to speak to him except to place an order. But Zeke did find endearing ways to compliment him from time to time without exposing their sweet relationship, such as after placing his order, which was always Chili Rellenos, remarking, "Not only is the food here quite good, but the view is outstanding." By the view, of course, he meant Arwin's glorious mug, for there was nothing impressive to see out the picture window, just a busy intersection surrounded by drab buildings and the occasional wino and bums with shopping carts rattling on by. Jane sought additional non-vocal ways to express his love for this Orange County gumshoe by writing one blog every 2 or 3 weeks about Arwin and how simply being in his presence makes Zeke so ridiculously happy. He'd slip a printout of each episode secured in a decorated plastic folder beneath an old newspaper. Since Arwin also cleared tables, he'd be the first to find it. This lasted almost a year before Jean decided to cease his weekly visits in order to make clear he was no stalker. Huh. 2 months later, the restaurant closed. Those blog entries, by the way, now compose his online novel called The Arwin Chronicles, 29 chapters in all. When the taqueria phase ended, Arwin made sure Zeke could see him within every 2 or 3 weeks by showing up nearby, say, walking in opposite direction along the sidewalk and passing by as if neither knew the other, or some months later showing up out of the blue, now employed at a local bar, the Metro, which has since shut down, right across the street from Jean's apartment building. Darling reader, may I remind you that Arwin's keen telepathy certainly helped the process along. Zeke could now look right out the hallway window and see Arwin at work or smoking a ciggy on the wraparound deck. The bar was on the second floor, as was Jean's SRO, so he'd sometimes visit, buy a drink, and enjoy Arwin's presence once more from a respectful distance. Some days, Zeke would even stand kitty-corner across the street and hold his hat to his heart while looking up at Arwin, who took frequent cigarette breaks on the sun deck. This way, Jean could send his love from a very safe distance with no one the wiser. It was a large, busy five-corner intersection at Market 16th and Noe. Arwin would just puff on a Marlboro with vigor while looking directly at his beloved sidekick for as long as he could before returning to work. An element of humor in these little scenarios was not lost on Zeke. Surely Arwin's playful spirit was a great balm. Around this time of the Metro, the funding for this assignment from Orange County dried up, and busting the Hells Angels drug runners became a cold case. Arwin was therefore required to return to Southern California or lose his career. In a heartbeat, he chose the latter. No way was he going to leave his beloved amigo vulnerable to these cult fanatics, for Jean would likely be severely crippled or even murdered as a result. So in losing his noble job, he also lost his health benefits. Thus began the rotting and loss of his gorgeous pearly whites, small sacrifice to pay, in his mind, in order to protect the soul of one so dear. Arwin turned to hustling men in their 70s, mostly, at select gay bars in the Castro, not for sex, of course, but for nightly companionship. Fully clothed or in pajamas, he'd hold these lonely, though affluent, elder gentlemen in his gangly arms, make them feel very much loved and appreciated. Mornings, Arwin would usually fix them coffee and breakfast in his underwear and tell many cheerful jokes and compliments. If there's one thing Arwin excels at, it's bringing joy to the hearts of aging or severely disabled men who otherwise would have no purpose in their lonely lives or any reason to get out of bed each day. Some suffered major health issues such as cancer, AIDS, and even dementia. Arwin loved them all to the point where they found life exceedingly wonderful again, or perhaps even for the first time. He graced them with his beauty, friendship, and humor, and in exchange received $100 to $500 a nightly pop. He could have gotten so much more because of his startling good looks and talent, but he intentionally sought more needful clientele, for Arwen is truly a lover to his brothers in great need. He uses his dragon-given beauty for all the right reasons, and this is why Jean harbors such golden affection for this most courageous and compassionate detective, the first man ever to make him forget his other great love, Randolph Lewis Taylor. So, now we are caught up to the present time, and the completion of this episode, Chapter 13, Arwen is so close to busting these scoundrels, he can taste it like stale tobacco from an overnight tryst, and Zeke will soon have this novel published and become wealthy beyond anyone's comprehension, and, of course, outrageously, impossibly, scintillatingly famous as well. Their teeth will be repaired by the best oral surgeons and dental technicians money can buy, or simply healed in a flash by dragonly white magic, and Jean will open his first home for severely disabled gay veterans, employing his buddies off the streets to be their companions, maintain the building and grounds, and handle the books. Wouldn't that be nice? Generally, when I'm in Fort Bragg, there's a man named Ezekiel J. Kralin, which is not his real name, but it's been his name for so long, and it's as much like a real name as any name could possibly be. I'm not sure why he changed it to that, but that's his name now. And he calls at about 1 o'clock in the morning whenever I'm there and reads a story that he's written, some kind of gay advocacy, vaguely porn-like science fiction private detective story. I mean, he's pretty interesting.
Oh, that old niche.
Well, yeah, but, you know, everybody can't be Yasha Heifetz.